Good day. You're listening to European Buddha.
All right. Greetings to everyone out there and hello on a warm evening in Vienna that pretty much feels like spring already. Today I'm looking at 1, 2, 3, 4 screens right now. One familiar being Emilia. Hello, Emilia.
Hello, Martin.
And the other ones are showing our guests we invited for today's episode about Echo Dharma. Hello, Silvia Francesco.
Hello, Martin.
And Jake Lyon.
Hi, Martin.
So the EBU has a growing list of projects, one of them being the Echo Dharma group. And Silvia and Jake are in charge of this group, and today we want to look at it and present this network for people, of people, who are involved in Buddhism, ecology, and climate emergency. So to give our audience a little bit of background information about our two guests, I will present Silvia Francesco. She is currently responsible for the ecological agenda of the Italian Buddhist Union, with a special focus on climate justice. She has an international environmental background in law studies, and she has been the director of the Rome Office of the European Council on Foreign Relations for quite some years, for 9 years. So is that about right, Silvia?
Yes, it is. I guess the most important thing, by the way, is the work that I'm doing with the Italian Buddhist Union. And I feel very privileged to have this opportunity.
And Jake Lyon is a coordinator of the Echo Dharma group and is very interested in this specific field, in this specific topic of environmental issues and climate change. He has practiced with a number of Buddhist teachers, mostly in the Chan tradition. He is a past chair of the Western Chan Fellowship and has experience as a Buddhist teacher and having led retreats for over 15 years. So we have these interesting people here and this very interesting topic about Echo Dharma. But before we start, let's maybe just start with a very personal question. We often ask our guests, how did you came across the Dharma? And maybe you can also have this connection. What is your connection to nature? Like maybe Dharma and nature. How does this goes together with you guys?
So yes, I came across Dharma around 30 years ago. And I'm coming from the Mahayana Tibetan tradition. And actually, I didn't even know what I was doing because I read a magazine, which is called Siddhi, and I discovered that there was a Buddhist center in my hometown, which is a very little city near Venice. And I remember I used to go with my bike every Tuesday evening and listening to, you know, the teachings and practicing meditation there. And there were all these things like the concept of sunyata and interdependence and impermanence. I couldn't understand anything about it, but I kept going. I'm not saying that today I understand it, but at least intellectually, I'm more advanced than 30 years ago. What is nature for me? For me, nature is the mother, is the teacher, and the healer. And to me, Dharma is nature. Today we are going to talk about eco-dharma, but somehow I think that, you know, the Buddhist teachings are so radically ecological that it goes without saying that Dharma is profoundly and deeply ecological. The Buddha was a radical ecologist. The way he, for the teachings, of course, but also the way he lived and the enlightenment and the birth and the death of the Buddha are extremely connected to nature?
So, well, I started meditating when I was about 20. I had no particular teacher at the time. And my first contact with Buddhists was when I met Tibetans in the Himalayas in 1974. And these were people in exile. Despite being away from their homeland, what was noticeable was the sort of lightness and joyfulness of the Tibetan community. But my first real contact with Dharma in terms of practice was my first retreat. And that was in 1982. And it was in a retreat center in the center of Wales, very primitive, no electricity, no central heating. We did have a log fire, no hot water, and which was all very pertinent because we actually got snowed in during the retreat. And it was a Western Zen retreat. This is a retreat where you work with, just as a traditional Zen retreat, you might work with a question, a traditional question like, what is mu, for example. The westernization of it was to work with the question. The first question was, who am I? So this was the method of practice to work with the question, who am I? And then the further retreat, what is life, which is very relevant to what we're talking about. And the teacher was John Crook, Dr. John Crook, who was a Chan master, but also a biologist and evolutionary psychologist. So the teachings were very rooted in nature. And I felt at the time, actually, that we were pioneers of pioneers, really, in a new path. You could say returning to our place in nature. So it was really full of hope at the beginning, although, of course, things would turn out very differently in the world. And in terms of connection to nature, well, like you, Martin, I am nature. I thought about this today and I thought, actually, there isn't a separation, although we can have the power in our heads to separate ourselves. And it's rather more that I like to think of this hugely long, distant connection to some single-celled organism about 2 billion years ago, and there's been absolutely no break all the way down to the four of us and everybody else who's listening. But in the sense that you meant it, well, I've always had a strong connection to nature, and I was brought up in the country and at a time when you could play outside safely, so I just love being outside. And where I live as well, I'm very close to, I mean, a place where it's very dark, and so I can see the stars at night and hear the owls in the morning. So, yeah.
Thank you for sharing those beautiful stories. And it just made me feel like I know what you're talking about. You know, it's always when you go to nature, all the busy mind and thoughts drop and you just feel so connected, which is wonderful and great. As you were memorizing your past and how you come across Dharma, do you recall maybe a teaching or a story that could help us develop this connection towards nature?
Well, I think every time we go to nature is Dharma practice. So the story, I think, is the experience, if you want, in the sense that, for example, I've always been in nature since very early ages. And maybe I didn't call it Dharma practice, but it was a practice and it was a Dharma practice. So I think what Jake said before is the story of non-separation. When you're in nature, you realize that there is no duality, as we say, but you feel you are nature. And you know, if you have thoughts and perhaps problems and, you know, everything goes away while you're in nature, because you precisely have the feeling that you don't need anything else. You are not missing. You're missing nothing in nature.
Exactly. And it's like you're not comparing.
No, I mean, because you're part of it. You are nature, as Jake was saying before. And sometimes, you know, we hear people and also, you know, maybe some marketing advertisements, etc., say, you know, go and see this and see that, see the sunset and go and watch the mountains. But that is a very... you know, it talks about separation, and sometimes we don't see a sunset. We are a sunset. You know, we don't see a mountain. We are a mountain. we're part of it. We're made of, you know, the same thing. And so that, I think, is the story that the Buddhas talked to us about, you know, the non-separation and the story of the leaf, right? Because a leaf is made of the sun, of the soil, of the rain. So it's this interdependence of phenomena, of things. So that, I think, is the great story and the exciting story about it.
When Sylvia was saying about, you know, seeing the mountain and you are the mountain, it reminds me of an experience that I had a couple of years ago. I was in skiing in Chamonix, and I went to the Mer de Glace. I don't know if you know about the Mer de Glace. It's the largest glacier in the Alps, I believe. And the Mer de Glace, you know, 100 years ago, was quite high up the mountainside. At the foot of it, they built a railway which goes from Chamonix right up to the edge of the Mer de Glace, and then you get a small lift down, and then you get to the Mer de Glace, and people could walk out onto it. It was the kind of thing Victorians used to like to do. And but from 1985 up until the present time, the Mer de Glace has been shrinking. And it's so noticeable when you get there. It actually touches your heart to go and see how much it's shrunk. So you go to I ski down to the bottom, and then you have to walk steps up to get to where this lift used to come down. So you have to go up a lot of steps, and it's gone up 115 meters since 1985. That's the amount that the glacier has shrunk at that particular point. So you just walk up and up and up, and you get to the top, and then you look down and you see how far down it's gone and how small the people are below. And that's when that is, to me, a very, very strong sense of connection, painful connection to nature.
And I think this would be maybe one of the things that is required for actual change, to have this personal affection or experience, because it's one thing that we know about climate change and something needs to be done, but another thing to actually experience it and experience yourself also as a part of something. And I think this is one of the key problems we face today. We know things are going down in a certain road, but somehow we are not that capable of actually doing something about it. And this is for me where Dharma, or the perspective of Dharma in the Buddhist teachings, are very interesting, because it's based on experience and then things are developing. But on the other hand, and maybe Sylvia, this is also for you, these questions, of course, they cannot be all solved on a just personal level. We can stack it up to a more political level, then we have laws, then we have decisions.
Yeah, well, my experience goes back to many years ago when I was doing negotiations and international environmental agreements in the international scene. But I have also to say, and that was 20 years ago, and I have to say that following COP26, nothing has changed much. Negotiations are very slow. There is more awareness, of course, also amongst the politicians of the emergency of the eco-crisis. However, if you think that the mention of fossil fuels for the first time happened actually at COP26, meaning that we needed 26 COPs before having fossil fuels mentioned into the decisions of the leaders within the UN system, well, you can tell it's a very slow process. So I think much of what I can see in terms of movement is outside the doors, outside the decision-making process. And again, COP26 was very clear in this respect. The people, the gathering, the community that emerged throughout the years of, again, grassroots movements, indigenous people, NGOs, small smallholder farmers, etc., I think that is the most interesting thing. And that is what gives me hope for the future, rather than, you know, the decisions and the commitments at the political level that, by the way, are not kept eventually. So I think it's coming from these movements, the change.
How do you keep your spirits high and kind of keep the cool as cucumber mind? Do you have a special practice you do? Because I can imagine that things can heat up a lot during these happenings and discussions. Also, this question is for you, Jake, because you must meet a lot of people in these situations.
It's very difficult to work out one's approach to, you know, pessimism and optimism. When I mentioned to you before that my first retreat was in this place in Wales, a wonderful natural place, well away from everything else. And there was a sense, really, that we were, I had this sense anyway, that we were making a real connection with nature in a different way. We were, you know, bringing our awareness very much into the natural world. And it felt like forging a new path. So, you know, there was a time really that was full of hope. But since then, as Sylvie's been saying, the world crisis has actually been accelerating really dramatically and very shockingly, really. There's a person by the name, you may have heard of him, Paul Hawken, who's done a project called Drawdown and also Regeneration.
Yeah.
And he's spoken to many people in the world, as you know, who, as Sylvie was saying, who are doing lots of innovative and wonderful things. And his answer to this question, you know, when he's asked whether he's pessimistic or optimistic, he says that my answer is always the same. If you look at the science about what's happening on the earth and you aren't pessimistic, you don't understand data. But if you meet people who are working to restore this earth and the lives of people who are badly affected by the climate and you aren't optimistic, you haven't got a pulse. And I think it's just a wonderful way of expressing this. But, you know, for myself, sometimes I find I've become really very angry. After COP and COP26 and the talk about, at least there's been some discussion about coal, you might remember, rather weak. And then to discover actually that the amount of coal that's being burnt is increasing in the world at the moment. But having said that, I'm not sure really that the question of optimism and pessimism is really very, very fundamental, because, you know, as Buddhists, we take on a path, and that we might say the Bodhisattva path. And the path is to make a commitment, to make a vow, and not to be too concerned about outcomes, but to do what one feels is the right thing to do. And, you know, for myself, I won't be alive to see these longer term outcomes anyway, but I feel it's my job, really, and my joy to do whatever I can do. It's obviously going to be very small, but I'll still do it. Yeah.
I think Jake touched upon an extremely important point, not being attached to the result of your action. You do it. It's your vow. You are doing something bigger than yourself that transcends yourself. You are not doing it alone. You're doing it in a community, in a sangha. And you do it every single day you wake up and every single day you go to bed. But if you transform your sense of compassion for the animals, for the earth, for the forests and for the planet and for the human beings as well, and through the practice, I think you can transform that compassion from being grief to being action. And again, not being attached to the result, I think is extremely important. Also because we have a responsibility to give a legacy. It's not, I think it's part of the Buddhist practice, is not to be too much self-centered in your own action. You're not going to save the planet, right? Yourself. We are not so important at the end of the day. But our collective action, the Sangha, is the important, is the real jewel here. So I see, again, when I see the movements, as I said before, and I see the commitments of so many people working on many, many different levels, you know, there are the youth, but there are also the farmers. Jake mentioned Paul Okwen and his regenerative work and how important is, for example, regenerative agriculture for our soil, and actually how this system can be so helpful for combating, you know, the climate crisis. That is hope, I think. The plants are hope. The resilience of the soil and the plants provide hope. And that's why I said before that nature is the teacher.
Beautiful. And this you could practice also at the retreat and EcoSattva training. Is that right?
Yes, we are organizing quite a lot of things as Italian Buddhist Union with our agenda. One is a journey into the Ecodharma. We will start in March 27th with David Loy with us. And that is going to be basically a webinar where we will have exchanges with teachers. We start around May an EcoSattva training that has the purpose of offering a tool to practitioners in order to handle, if you want, the eco-anxiety that could emerge from the ecological crisis and how to respond in an appropriate way to the ecological crisis without, being overwhelmed by it, and how our practice can help us. And this is the EcoSattva training. And we will have, however, as you mentioned, Emilia, an EcoDharma retreat in September. David Loy again will be with us. He will be the lead teacher and will be from 23rd to 30th of September this year at the L'Amazzon Kappa Institute in Tuscany, in the beautiful environment immersed in nature in Tuscany, in Italy.
And I really want to acknowledge this great term, EcoSattva. It's like if the listeners or some of the listeners didn't notice, it's a wordplay of the famous Bodhisattva who vows in his compassion to serve all sentient beings on their journey of life, that is, at some point, the awakening to their true nature. It's very interesting when the East, the so-called East and the West are meeting, what is happening there? And we have this great term already, EcoSattva, so I really want to acknowledge that. And it really sounds good, this training. And you are just starting, right?
Yes, we are just starting, and it's an encouragement to go beyond the meditation room, right? To take action in the world as bodhisattvas, as people have, you know, the vows and the commitment to live a significant life. And yes, I'm also very, very happy about this. And by the way, I should acknowledge that this is done in partnership with One Health Sangha, which is based in the United States. So I like this because I think that the Buddhist community is becoming bigger and bigger and is becoming a true ecological worldwide Sangha. There are so many initiatives around the world from the Buddhist community. And I think we should acknowledge that. And going back to what we were saying before, we are not alone. We are many, many people, practitioners, engaged in eco-activism and practice. And I dream the day where we are going to have like a conference with all the traditions, a global conference with all the Buddhist communities. That would be fantastic, I think.
It's great. It's like we talk with our last guest, Stefano from Italy, the Dharma hugging the whole
absolutely,
world.
Absolutely, yes.
What could be something that everyone could do right now for the environment?
We have a project called the CFAB project. This is what can Buddhist centers do a little bit towards the environment. So CFAB stands for Sustainable Environment on Earth for All Beings. And the aim of the project is to work with Buddhist centers and institutions in Europe to look at environmental management, you know, reducing, using renewable energy, paying attention to water, the use of water, and how resources are used, what is bought, what is not bought, how people travel and so on, biodiversity. And this project, we've got five institutions in Sweden who are going to take part, four temples and one cafe, as it happens, one Buddhist cafe. And we have a center in Spain, and we have a center in France. And the one in France is interesting because their center actually burnt down completely. And they're rebuilding it. So part of this project will be looking at how they do the building in a way which is environmentally sensitive and good use of materials and so on. And in this project, each centre will be working with one person who's, a senior member of the centre, and one person who's very young in the centre. It's a youth engagement project. And the aim is to help people become more aware of how they're running their centre and what they can do to work towards a more sustainable approach.
Is there something Buddhist centers are forgetting or are not aware of, maybe like in the sense of waste protection?
We had a good discussion about this earlier today, actually, with the Swedish Buddhist Union, and they were talking about having big celebrations. And for example, people coming and them having throwaway plates, throwaway cups, instead of people bringing their own plates and their own cups. So one very specific example of something that people could do. And of course, there are many things like that.
Yeah, from a personal view, I think the first advice I will give is to try to practice in nature as much as possible. I think that is already so much. And then, of course, there are so many things we can do also at the individual level. The one that works for me best is asking myself, do I really need it? Do I need that thing? The other question I ask myself is, where does it come from? And this happens a lot with food, for example, and clothes, for example. I tend not to buy clothes, by the way, but also as a mother, I try to, you know, educate my kids, my children to these kind of questions. Where did this product come from? But also at the same time, understanding that our individual behavior is extremely important, but I guess it's more important for our own awareness is our own practice, because I understand that if I just, you know, switch off the light, it's not going to change much, you know, at the global level. So it's very much a sense of awareness, what I'm doing. However, I also think that, you know, when we talk about individual footprint, again, it is extremely important, but I urge also not to fall into the trap of the individual footprint, because, you know, this was invented, actually, the footprint exercise, by a company that was hired by BP in order to divert the attention from the big emitters, from the big polluters, to individual behaviors. So, of course, I would encourage everybody to be more mindful of how we walk on Earth. And I would like to remember our beloved teacher Thich Nhat Hanh, who used to say, you know, walk as you were kissing the earth with your feet, which is extremely beautiful. But also, we need also to be able to speak the truth. And the truth is, there are big emitters, there are big polluters, and we shouldn't do the blame and shame on people, because this risk to divide us a lot. And another point I'm very much concerned about is this division, is this blame and shame attitude. I'm more vegan than you kind of thing, right? We shouldn't, I think, fall into this trap. We should keep accountable the governments, the companies, for what they are doing.
Taking up Sylvia's point about the relationship between our footprint and the pollution that's actually being done on a very large scale, I was very struck. My first teacher, John Crook, one day he said, "Life is a fight." And I was a bit struck by that, because you don't hear Zen masters or Buddhist masters saying that very often. But actually, if you think about it, that is the way that a lot of the world operates. If you go into a jungle, it's a kind of fight between one plant or another plant to get light and so forth. Mm-hmm. So there's some truth in that. And I think it's very important to understand that there is a massive challenge going on between people who want to stop this juggernaut, which is threatening to push us off the edge of a cliff, and those people who want to go on in that direction. Of course, we don't fight with foolish rage, and we don't want to seek a victory over someone, but we must win this argument.
Thank you very much, both of you. I think you are both great examples of inspiration, and people and all you listeners are encouraged to join the Ecodharma group, to be part of the trainings and the retreats that are going to offer, and share your own history, your own experience, and bring yourself in, because everybody, I think, is greatly appreciated on this journey together. And as Sylvia was saying, it's like a Sangha thing. It's like this precious jewel that we have in collective awareness. And so this is my hope when I'm just picturing that. This is like the brilliance of humanity when we go together with this kind of broad vision.
Thank you. Together, let's take action.
Thank you so much. And Jake and I'm speaking from the Dolomites, by the way. And yes, wow. yes. And it's just beautiful. And I know Jake appreciates, because he's also a climber and a mountaineer. So tomorrow morning, first thing will be practice in the forest.
Oh, lovely. Yeah.
I'll take you with me.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's been a very enjoyable thing to do, and very interesting as well. So it's been great to share this with you, Sylvia. And thank you, Martin and Amelia, for hosting us.
Indeed.
We don't know each other very well, you see. So it's nice to get to know each other a little bit better, because we're obviously working together on this.
Yeah, very, very much so, I think, Jake. It's important to meet. We should meet more often, I think.
In the Dolomites, of course.
Yeah.